Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of The New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, science policy and politics, and the North Pole. He has served as adjunct professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, teaching environmental reporting, and is the senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University. His books include The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez, and The Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Refkin.
Good to be with you.
And do you think, I suppose it's pretty clear that given that Hurricane Irene was not as devastating as was expected, I think this, the political subtext there always, surely, Andrew, was that was Katrina, right? That all the politicians didn't want to repeat that mistake.
Well, yeah, and the point you raised depends on whose expectations you're talking about. I mean, the climate and the weather forecasters that I was keeping in touch with were always indicating, you know, there's always uncertainty, and anyone who said there was a forecast of a devastating storm was looking at hype, not at reality. The media had expectations that did sort of overblow, I think, things in a way that when you really look at what the National Hurricane Center was putting out, is not what the actual forecasts were. It's really important to look at those. They have a zone. You know, everyone looks at the track and thinks that there's a line that this hurricane is going to follow. And in fact, it's that bubble around the track that there's not even a sense of probability within that bubble about where that storm will be. So I do think it's important to deflate the idea that this was badly forecast in that sense.
Well,
begs the question of, like, you know, the political ramifications and stuff.
Well, no, but the point you've raised is one that I've been aware of, you know, we have it out here all the time in California. Every time a storm front comes through, and you see the pictures over the Pacific, it's billed with theme music, Storm Front 2011, with triple Doppler radar.
And correspondents tied to telephone poles.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm just sick. It culminated, of course, when they closed the freeway down. You know, they call it Carmageddon. There was so much hype that the entire city was going to be paralyzed and people would be shooting each other over a can of tuna. And in fact, it was a beautiful weekend where you could hear the birds and relax in the garden with your family.
Right. And now getting at the other point about, how do you gauge an emergency response when you have a certain level of uncertainty and you have all that hype? It's a tough question. I think the mayor of New York did the right thing by calling for those evacuations because all it takes is a few hours, a few tweaks of the trajectory, a few factors in the atmosphere going the other direction, and you have a much more powerful storm and a bigger surge. And the question, of course, and this comes up in tornado country too, which is even worse, how do you maintain vigilance and responsiveness when you have a high false alarm rate, which is the case with tornadoes all the time, and with hurricanes much more rarely. But even there, it's still an issue. How do you get people to evacuate when most experience with evacuations isn't the worst case? It's a tough question.
Well, Andrew Refkin, given that the press did overblow it, and you're saying that if you had listened carefully to what the weather people were saying, and the professional hurricane forecasters, that it wasn't going to be as bad as it was hyped. Is it true that the press missed? They were so focused on storm surges and others, they have missed the second stage, which is all of that rain that's now causing flooding up in New England in particular? Or is that yet more media hype? Because that seemed to be...
No, it's not. In fact, I live halfway up the Hudson Valley, and we've had a disastrous, not disastrous in terms of lost lives, but disastrous in terms of impacts on roads and ultimately on economies, people not being able to get to work and stuff. I must say, if people have been reading .earth, they would have known my second post, way back on Tuesday, I wrote a piece that basically said the flood risk is likely going to be the big thing. And I didn't mean coastal flooding. The this is a rainfall storm, and because it was very reminiscent, looking at it, of Hurricane Floyd, which became much more destructive, which had a lot of destruction as a tropical storm, you know, compared to what it had a lot of impact on the Carolinas, which are fairly sparsely populated as a powerful hurricane, but in 1999 it had a terrible impact in the Northeast as just a drenching rainmaker. And that's, in fact, what we saw here. There's towns in the Catskills right now that I haven't gotten to, but I've been there in epic floods before, and I know what they're facing, which is sort of Katrina-style people on rooftops.
And is that, has that reached its peak, the flooding
Some rivers are still rising because of the sort of a delay in the system, but mm-hmm. most are at peak or not, or past it.
So that's really where the damage was done by this hurricane, not on the coast, but inland.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, too, you know, coasts in general, people who live on vulnerable coasts outside of places like New York City perhaps do know how to behave. There's still an unfortunate habit in this country of subsidizing hurricane, you know, sort of storm insurance in places where people simply shouldn't be building. And so that leads to this unbelievable phenomenon that I saw firsthand in 2004 when I was covering Hurricane Ivan in Alabama. And I went to this place called Dauphin Island, kind of like a low-key version of the Hamptons, or where you have houses built right on the beach. And people were just basically looking at the waves, destroying their houses, and saying they know they're going to get a check in the mail and build back bigger the next time. And it just was utterly aggravating to see that mindset at work.
Well, you're beginning to sound like Ron Paul.
Well, you know, I hate irrational subsidy. Sure, my God.
Well, it's no accident, of course, that these people are extremely wealthy, and they've probably got political connections. So,
And the ones in Alabama were more middle class.
I see.
That's what I.
So this is not Malibu, Malibu in the South, right?
Blue-collar Malibu.
So, again, I'm speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of The New York Times' .earth blog, where he has covered global environmental issues that have included climate change and, of course, hurricanes. And we're talking about Hurricane Irene, which Andrew has told us was actually forecast correctly but somewhat overblown by press hype. But nevertheless, real damage is being done inland by the enormous amount of rainfall and the flooding that's happening. What is the climate change angle here? Because you know, clearly we've been having series of extreme weather events with more frequency, with more intensity, and at some point or other we're going to run out of money with these federal disaster loans.
Yeah, well, in this instance, it's important to not lump all disastrous weather into one batch and say it's all global warming. Tornadoes, for example, the science just isn't there to find that link. So while there is clear, you know, we had an unbelievable tornado season this year, epic damage, the damage toll was substantially because there's so many more people living in the Southeast and sort of Tornado Alley and the adjacent areas than there were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, the last time similar fronts came through. So it's just really important to not sort of oversimplify the situation. Now, that said, expectations are, and actually recent history for heavy downpours is that in North America, at the very least, there's a tendency toward having more rain, more of the rain that comes coming in heavy downpours. And that, again, hurricanes, as I just explained, and as we just witnessed, a big chunk of their damage can come through rain as opposed to wind and coastal flooding. So, and then you when you add sea level rise, which is one of the most basic results of warming the planet, then you are talking about rising vulnerability to storms of this kind. It could be, and there's a chunk of science pointing to this, that there'll be fewer hurricanes overall in a warmer or warming world than there are now. The chances of hurricanes once forming, getting into more intense scale categories, is probably higher. And all of this is still in contention within the scientific community. This is not false controversy. This is real controversy because we don't understand hurricanes very well. They live or die based on very complicated mix of factors. And and they're rare, so you don't have a statistical picture that's clear. So we can't.
But I recall at the time of Katrina, as it was coming in, that there was talk that there was a global warming effect because the ocean was warmer. But
that
was just
Katrina was incorrectly. I think it's pretty clear now, and I think a lot of hurricane and climate researchers would agree that there's no clear picture there. In fact, remember, it was a very weak storm over New Orleans. Once the winds over the city were actually, I think, Category 1 or below, and there the problem was vulnerability. The city had never been adequately armored on the side away from the Mississippi River, and you had a city that would have gone under sooner or later by some hurricane, whether or not you had global warming. It was almost inevitable. It did go over a warm pocket of water, but the Gulf of Mexico every year is a mixture of these loop currents. I wrote about them. They even have names. Scientists give them names that can bring sort of really unusually hot water around. But right now, the Gulf is actually not at a very hot level compared to some recent years. So there are no straight lines you can draw. And again, it sounds almost boring and kind of counter to what would be a headline thought, but, you know, in a warming world, you will expect storms to be more severe, but you can't presume that there was any, you know, looking at a storm like Katrina, you can't ever blame a single storm or its outcome on this thing, this impact.
So,
which
but
is really, again, the natural variability year to year is still greater than what's thought to have happened already from warming.
So since this is not, there's no cause and effect here to global warming, is that to say then that global warming deniers will have more ammunition? We've got a guy running for president now.
Who's
the head of the Republican PAC, I might add.
one of the tough realities here is people who want stasis, people who don't want us to move off of fossil fuels, have a very easy task because I say it's almost like another law of physics. Society at motion a society at rest tends to stay at rest. Human beings on fossil fuels is a very comfortable and it's like being deeply sunk into a couch, and getting someone off that couch requires an enormous amount of effort, and having them stay on the couch requires almost no effort. So those who want to keep us in our current mindset have this unbelievably easy task. All they need is a tiny little bit of uncertainty. And unfortunately, the science of climate change will always give that just enough of that stuff that they'll probably have their easy task accomplished. And it's not because, it's not like each side has an equivalent challenge here. And that's what makes this very hard energy policy so hard to push forward in America.
But I think Rick Perry's notion that scientists are going wild and running off half-cocked
is
total
panicking.
Nonsense, because if you talk to any scientist, every scientist I ever talked to, they are the most conservative people on the planet. They do not get out ahead of their own information.
No. And I just wrote a piece today chastising the conservative columnist George Will for not going after these Republican frontrunners, as he did in January. When the new Republican Congress House came in, George Will, of all people, wrote a column saying, don't diss science. Science, the Republican Party needs to be cognizant of and a leader on this nation restoring its scientific leadership. And here, you know, you have people like Governor Rick Perry trying to sort of demean and throw doubt on all of climate science on the basis of a few stray threads that were a short-term news story and that have no real ramifications for the overall body of evidence pointing to a human-heated planet. And George Will, in earlier columns, made the same fallacious argument that just essentially trying to toxify the whole enterprise on the basis of a few controversies, and that's a regrettable thing, especially when Will in another column says we really have to care about science and give scientists support they need to make this country a leader again. You kind of can't have it both ways.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Andrew Refkin.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Refkin, who is a reporter for The New York Times and creator of The New York Times' .earth blog, where he's covered global environmental issues that have included climate change, Hurricane Katrina, the Asian tsunami, and science, policy, and politics. His books include The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez, and The Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a CIA interrogator about torture.